Welcome to PLM Evolution, your gateway to the forefront of digital thread and digital transformation, and all things PLM. On this show, we'll unpack the perspectives of industry pioneers, bringing you compelling conversations from the dynamic world of product innovation at today's leading enterprises. Now, here's your host, Patrick Sullivan.
Hey, everybody. It's been a little hiatus here from the PLM Quick 30. We've gone back to the war room and rebranded the podcast to be Digital Transformation Through the Eyes of PLM. And our first guest, I'm very excited to introduce Anton Wilson. He's the president of Guidance Solutions. But the thing that was so intriguing about our conversation when we spoke almost a year ago now was it's very rare that I've been able to talk with somebody who has a long arc of a career where they've actually spanned from design to manufacturing to supply chain and been able to identify areas of value and help improve the business in various scenarios throughout his career. So I'm very excited about this episode. We're going to have a great conversation. So let's introduce Anton now, let him talk about himself, and then we'll start diving into the crux of the conversation. So thanks for joining us. And Anton, I appreciate you being available and your willingness to be on the podcast.
Thank you, Patrick. I really appreciate the invitation. I'm glad to do it. It's interesting that I'm able to talk to people about the whole supply chain to retail conundrum, all the things that need to happen. So a little bit about myself. My background is in textile technology from North Carolina State University, but I went to work in manufacturing, apparel manufacturing, cut and sew with the old Bluebell, which is now Wrangler division, Kontoor. And I'm very fortunate because their training program was, in my opinion, and any opinion of several other people in the industry, was outstanding for getting, allowing us to get involved in every aspect of the business. So, you know, I learned cutting, I learned product development, costing, distribution, quality, everything was a part of what we learned. And so after several years there, I also ended up working for Lee, H.D. Lee, which at the time was a division of VF, Vanity Fair, now also Kontoor Brands. And so transitioned to them, learning more about how fashion comes to the fair, because Lee was more fashion driven than Wrangler was. Even though we think of both of them as denim companies, they had a wide range of apparel. And Lee was more into the design and merchandising. But one of the things that happened in my career with Lee, I thought was interesting, was I was brought in. I had already become head of quality for the company. I'd run a factory for them. I'd been head of engineering for a while. I ran some factories for a while. But at one point near the end of my time there, they put me into a team that was working on early stages of digitalization, payroll and production planning. And so I worked cross-functionally there with their IT department. And so it was my first exposure to that and realizing the value of data collection and data management. And that before everything was decentralized. With this process we were putting in place, we could have centralized views and centralized reporting. Among other things I did there, I also ran a laundry operation, by the way. So between fabric manufacturing all the way to finished garment, I've done it all. I also worked with unions too, so I learned to negotiate there. But an interesting thing happened. I was recruited away.
So one second before, and just I apologize for interrupting, sure. But just for the benefit of the audience, depending on, because we have a wide variety of industries that will be listening to this.
Sure.
So I'm interested in a couple of things just for the benefit of everybody. The difference between fashion and apparel. And then you were talking about quality and then fabric manufacturing and then running laundry. There's likely folks that aren't aware of all the details existing in the RFA world. So would you take a minute to explain a little bit of that? And then we'll step back into the recruiting side.
Sure. I think about, I transitioned from apparel to fashion is that the early part of my career, I felt that cut and sew was basically just a service. And seasons were very long. Deliveries were, volumes were quite heavy. Warehouses were built and then product was sold out of wholesale. And you really didn't, on the manufacturer side, you didn't really feel the impact as often of seasonality, color change, fabric change, style change. Over time, the industry began to shift back in the 70s, moving into the 80s, to where demand was being driven by more rapid style changes. And so I start to use the term fashion industry because when you look at it from the manufacturing perspective, you see much more changes, shorter volume runs, different ways of value being added that go beyond just your ability to provide labor. So today I tend to use the word fashion industry more than apparel industry.
Got it.
That's just my convention. And again, Lee was more fashion driven, both as a strategy, but also as a change in the times. They were reacting much more quickly. In terms of the why I brought in the laundry is that back in the early 70s, for those of a certain age, we remember when you never bought, all your denim was bought rigid. The story used to be that if you bought a pair of Levi's, the first thing you do is fill a bathtub full of water, put the Levi's on in the tub, let them get wet, and then let them shrink around you. It was rigid denim and it was shrinked. So, today, hardly anybody ever conceives of buying rigid denim. And it was 14-ounce denim back then. It was very heavy. So at that point in my career, where garment washing, finished garment finishing, acid washes, stone washes, different treatments were coming in. At Lee Company, we decided to put in commercial laundries instead of using outside laundry services, which had been the norm for the industry. And so my factory, I was general manager of the factory. We ran a laundry operation 24/7. We ran cut and sew operations two shifts a day because it was the urban cowboy phase and denim was hot. But the reality is by that time in my career, I'd actually had a range of products. I'd actually made tailored clothing briefly and made workwear briefly, knit shirts, woven shirts, a bit of underwear, outerwear. So a broad range of categories, but in my factory actually wasn't a denim factory. We converted it to denim. So because of the trend. So that's why I brought up the laundry, just because there are some things that are relevant today. Even today's world, if you just ignore denim, there are many products, many fashion products, where post-garment processing, including a wash or a rinse or a softening or a shrinkage, are critical components. Those things are not often considered in supply chains.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the normal consumer, right? You just try on your jeans or you try on your shirt and you take for granted how complicated the process is and what actually goes into it and all of the different efficiencies. You just pay your, price for that particular product, $50 or $100. And you don't think about, for instance, the fashion changing in quick turns with low volume. And then you think about, a white t-shirt, for instance, high volume. And categorizing that from an apparel perspective, but what does it take to actually have a white t-shirt, right?
Yeah.
Or denim jeans.
It's funny, a white t-shirt, for example, even a white t-shirt today has different attributes and properties that you wouldn't have found 30 or 40 years ago. Because we as consumers expect the product to fit exactly correctly the first time and always fit like that after every wash. So back in the old days, T-shirts weren't pre-shrunk. Nowadays, they're pre-shrunk. So they weren't necessarily artificially softened. Now they're softened. You get a lot of changes that have occurred from the consumer. Either the consumer has demanded it or we've provided it as an industry as a convenience factor. Now the consumers want what they want, then they get it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I told you before we started to record, I can go off into tangents, but I think your story is really relevant. I do want to dive into some of these details, sure. But I think it'll be blended in into later discussion. So I think you were still at Lee, you had been recruited away. So back to your background.
Okay. So a really big change in my career and a huge learning and growth opportunity for me was a company called BTK Industries, Billy the Kid. It was a children's wear brand. I'm actually old enough to remember when it was a better department store brand of children's wear. Family-owned business, going through a series of leveraged buyout, and had lost $42 million in the preceding three fiscal years before they were acquired in a bankruptcy sale by a conglomerate, and brought me in as VP Manufacturing, Chief Operating Officer, to turn the company around. We had to. It was a classic 80s turnaround story with all the good and the bad. We had to shut down factories. We had excess capacity. Warehouses full of product were manufactured for efficiency, but no sales existed. And we had to dispose of those. We had a very militant union that didn't take too kindly to having their factories shut down, and we had to manage through that. But I was able to break even the first year of operation on $100 million. Well, the interesting thing was they were a $100 million company at the time. They were very unprofitable at $100 million. And so the lesson was be profitable. Don't just grow. Now, you could argue that Jeff Bezos with Amazon has altered that story over the last 10 or 15 years with grow, don't worry about profits. But back then, it was very critical, especially because the company had been purchased and they wanted to recoup their investment that we turn a profit. So I had to shrink sales. That's what I had to do, profitable, and turn it around and restructure the organization of the company to eliminate some fat in the management team that had been there for years and years of family operation. And we were the second year we were beginning to make a profit. This is also where I became initially involved outsourcing internationally, because we were an El Paso based company. The ownership of the company wanted to Mexico. So we did some contracting, and they wanted me to actually move all production to Mexico. But back then I did an analysis with my leadership team, and we evaluated the pros and the cons. And the biggest con at that time was that the quality coming back wasn't equivalent to the quality that we were able to produce. The level of training, the skill level and training at that time wasn't what you would have wanted. And so I came into conflict with the board, and I was gently offered the door to go somewhere else because I didn't think that it was the right strategic move. Turned out I was right, because they brought in my replacement, and 12 months later they were bankrupt. So
if you don't mind me hitting the pause button again, you said something very interesting to me. So I've been, my background is in business development and sales, right? So you said one of the key things that you had to do was reduce sales in order to be profitable. Can you explain that a little bit, please?
So look at it this way. We had a sales projection. Well, I guess it's probably better that I say this. Some of the sales that were recorded never really went. Let's say that there was some spurious bookkeeping going on.
Oh.
All right. Okay. Maybe we weren't really a $100 million company, but that's what we were reporting at. So that was one part of it, was to say, look, we're not going to count a sale. Now, sales did not report to me. The only two areas of the company that did not report to me were sales and finance. But I worked hand in hand with the new head of sales, and we both went over things and we agreed on what was going on, that we were only going to sell, we're only going to report actual sales. Dropped a little bit. But the other part was we had to recognize that many of the actual sales that were recorded were then netted down based on returns. There was, we were selling, we weren't helping the account balance inventory to demand.
Okay.
We were just pushing product, giving them incentives to sell to or to buy. And the incentives were eating into our bottom line, as were the returns 3 months later eating into our bottom line.
Okay.
So we began to become more partnered with the buying organizations that were buying our wholesale brands. And so that was a huge part of it. The other part of it was that I said we had excess capacity, and I had to take the capacity down. And so a lot of the capacity that was placed was put in place just to keep the factory running. A lot like General Motors and Ford were doing in the 60s. They were running their factories full out so that they could keep the cost low, but they were stocking, building inventory, and then having to have incentives at the end of the model year. They're in the same boat. So we lowered capacity to a point where it was more in line with what we thought actual sales would be. And we were able to make that more efficiently because I could cut overhead and some operating costs. So all those things came.
That's fascinating. Okay. So I appreciate you explaining that further for me. And so the quality is clear to me, right? So what happened in your career when you made the transition from BTK?
So at that point, I took a short-term assignment. One would not have thought it was a short-term assignment, but I told my wife at the time and said, look, yeah, this guy is not going to be a long-term situation. Let's just recognize that this is a fill-in. But it was a very unique opportunity, and I actually got a lot out of it. I was only there for a year, but I worked for a family-owned business, an equivalent-sized company to BTK. It was a very large family-owned business. And I reported to the owner, directly to the owner, and I was literally his do-everything guy. In the span of a year, I transferred a large screen print operation, one of the largest screen print operations in the eastern U.S. He purchased it and moved it to eastern North Carolina and restarted it. I became general manager of that when the manager he had in place couldn't run it profitably. I turned a profit in the first month. Then I designed and built for him a garment dye facility.
So, you know, one of the things that I really want to try to dive into in these conversations is because you have a unique ability to be able to piece things together to do the right things to get profitability or return on investment. And so in the previous discussion, you had said that you had gotten to a break even in year one, which is from bankruptcy to break even is incredible. And so now there's an investment to move the screen print to North Carolina, and it was being mismanaged. And in the first year you got it, or I'm sorry, the first month you were able to get it profitable. Why?
So I don't think I'd like to pat myself on the and say that I've got this superpower that allows me to see these kinds of things. I wish it were that easy. But no, it was really more the individual that had been put in charge of managing the facility knew how to screen print. I did not. I wasn't a screen printer. I didn't, you know, I understood the mechanics of it, but I didn't understand, I didn't understand the quality of it the way he did, like choosing the right mesh of screen and knowing when the ink was the right viscosity. I didn't know that kind of stuff. What I knew was consumption. This goes back to my training at the old Bluebell organization. The utilization of raw materials, how much ink was being produced for this run? How many people were put on, like we had, for example, we had a 12-head screen print operation. How many workers did he put on there? How did he schedule them? It was all about looking at the components of cost relative to the quality that demanded or the delivery they demanded and balancing those. He just didn't do a great job of that. It wasn't, we have to say this, it wasn't rocket science.
Right.
And I should know, because when I went to college, I went to college in rocket science and transitioned to textiles. So yes, it does take a rocket scientist to understand the fashion industry.
Yeah. I just a little side story. I saw my niece last night, and she was an engineering major for 2 years. And she has switched over into another major, but she's taking statistics right now. Mm-hmm. And she said it's a very easy class. And I said, well, it's not really fair for an engineering student to go into
exactly
and say statistics is easy. So similar story of a rocket scientist going into a textiles.
Yeah. You know, I actually tell people that, strangely enough, back in those days, we didn't have PCs. We didn't have desktop computing. We had mainframes, and that the most valuable course I ever took wasn't physics. It wasn't thermodynamics. It wasn't any of that. It was computer programming. It was the most valuable course I took, because it taught me to think logically, because in those days you had to, when you built a program, you had to have things sequenced in an order. And if things needed to be done repetitively, and if you think about industry is about product development in the same way every time. It's about making this garment the same way every time. It's a repetitive process. You write a computer program in those days in Fortran or COBOL, you have to go back to a certain step number, and you'd have to have an exit strategy out of it. And so it really taught you to think logically, what has to happen next? How do you tell someone to do something in an order that allows them to effectively, efficiently, every time? You know, today, we don't teach that today because PCs don't function the same way. But the idea of learning to think logically about movement and steps is very critical. So I think whether you're an artist, a dancer, or something, if you have a little bit of that in your background, it's amazing assistance in a career path.
Yeah, that's... Well, I mean, that's great reflection, right? Ultimately, I do this podcast because we're looking for lessons learned and in reflection of accomplishments. How can people be more efficient and take some of those lessons learned and apply it for themselves? And I think looking backwards, it's a lot easier to, you know, connect the pieces, right? Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for that.
After a short sabbatical, which is not a sabbatical, it was a busy year. Then I went to work for Izod Lacoste Carolina, which was a division of Crystal Brands, which was itself a spun-off division from General Mills. And so General Mills had acquired, like a lot of conglomerates back in that era, they had acquired a lot of disparate companies. They put these together. In this case, when they decided to focus on their core competencies, they put these companies together because they were more consumer-focused and, quote, fashion-driven. There was a jewelry division, a Samsonite luggage, a couple of apparel companies. They were spun off in Crystal Brands. So we had no procedures, no policies, no standards, and I was in charge of engineering, product development, quality, and then I became head of production as well. This was my first exposure to actually living and working offshore, because we had our main facility for textiles was in North Carolina, but our production was all offshore. The company owned facilities, but offshore nonetheless. And so for a period of time, I took my wife and children and went down to Puerto Rico and ran not only that factory, which was our largest factory, but also facilities in Costa Rica, Dominican Republic, one in Costa Rica. So I got an exposure to what it's like to be on the other side of the coin, to be on the receiving end of what comes out of corporate. when it's in a different culture. I also, at this point, helped open up for our company anyway, Honduras as a contract operation for us, which was again an opportunity to get more involved in what was going on offshoring. I think if there was a lesson learned, I think the lesson was I took Spanish in school. I learned to speak shop floor Spanish when I was in El Paso because over 90% of my workforce, I only had six non-Hispanic people working for me. And most of them were Mexican nationals who had day passes that could come across the border. And so I learned to speak Mexican Spanish down to Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic. I learned that their Spanish is different. I asked, when I was in Mexico, I asked, if I want something done right now, how do I say that? And they said, you say, ahorita. I said, okay, great. So go down to Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic. And I wanted them to do a factory of relaying of the floor very quickly because I had a new stock coming in. I said, I want it done ahorita. They said, okay. I came back 4 hours later, nothing had done. And they said, I blew up. What's going on? What's going on? They said, Mr. Anton, you said we could do it whenever. What do you mean? Ahorita means meanwhile. It sounds like a joke. They began to realize it's not just language, but it's culture. You grow up having different, just because we all speak English doesn't mean we all think the same way. Just because we all speak Spanish doesn't mean we all think the same way. It's how we grew up. It's what norms you experience. And so when we started the factory in Costa Rica, for example, we started a dress shirt factory, built it from scratch. And we had to recognize that Costa Rican culture had a different ethic, had a different apt than Dominican. So this was another learning opportunity for me.
It's interesting that you explained that story. A couple of things pop into my brain that have happened to me personally, but you know, on the professional side, you know, we're in this world of PLM and digital thread and all of that, right? And mm-hmm. So if you think about how the data is created and its intention, and then how it's interpreted as it goes through, you know, the life cycle of the product, like, you know, in discrete world, it's like engineered or the EBOM, right? The engineering bill of material. And then there's the MBOM, and you compare the two of those. Companies really want those two to be aligned, but there's different interpretations and, you know, it takes up
swing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. But you know, you go to the people, so the people, process, and technology, and there's different interpretations on that. So, you know, we have a dedicated organizational change management group, and it's really interesting as we engage with executives and then management and then the user community of the different ways that messages are interpreted and need to be created in order to get collective buy-in from the entire organization.
Yeah.
So your specific example of what was the word? Ahorita?
Ahorita.
Yeah. That's a good one. It's a perfect example.
To continue that same thing, this was also where I learned basically what you're talking about, because our specs were written in North Carolina in English. Now, when we send that sheet to Puerto Rico, English is one of the two official languages of the island. It's part of the United States. So we had no issues. But when we sent those same specs to the Dominican Republic, we had issues because they didn't always as long as it was a common phrase or a common word, they understood it. But if it was a new way to put a seam together or something like that, it often required physical sample because they didn't understand. So this was another learning for me to recognize that in a global environment, you cannot presume. This is a major lesson that we had to deal with later in my career, you cannot presume that what you wrote in English is what's going to go out on the production floor. There will be a translation step that might or might not encompass exactly what you're talking about. And that's probably still true in the digital space. It was for us, and again, later in my career, part that was true for us. We created digital data, if you will, digital specs. We still had no way to control what went to the production floor.
Yeah, that's a, by the way, if anybody's watching this versus listening to it, my head is down because I'm taking notes. You know, there's, and I'm putting asterisks by big lessons so that we can highlight those once we publish this. So yeah, translation is a really interesting,
yeah,
very crucial spot to make sure that you're aligned.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, if you could continue down your background.
That, at that point, I was about halfway through what ended up being my career. It was offered an opportunity to go to Champion. Well, the Izod Lacoste division was being sold off. And so I worked with leadership of the company to sell them to a buyer, and they made it very clear that I was not going to be part of the team's going to transition. So I took a role with, I accepted a position with Champion Vision and what was then Sara Lee, now Hanes Brands. They've been spun off Hanes, but we were part of Sara Lee Corporation's consumer products division. And this was a major turning point for me because this represented the first challenge for me. I was head of engineering, which included not just industrial engineering and product costing, but I was also in charge of facilities engineering, which in our case represented a full textile array from knitting machines to dyeing machines and everything in between. And
just a quick second again for listeners' benefit who haven't had exposure. What is industrial engineering and facilities engineering? And if it's not clear in the explanation, what's the difference?
In the fashion world, when most people talk about engineering, they mean industrial engineering or efficiency engineering, if you will. It's as I mentioned earlier, it's about understanding the value of time and the value of materials and the consumption of both. That's really what industrial engineering is about. So it often involves work measurement or measurement of utilization of raw materials. It involves building work aids, designing workspace for maximum efficiency, those kinds of things. But it rarely directly involves the building or the mechanical, the HVAC, the air compressor. Sometimes you'll design an air system for it, but typically don't lay out those kinds of things in big space. But in facilities engineering, we were responsible for everything that sat on the ground. So we built a factory from scratch. It'd be about ordering materials, the construction schedule. In fact, my first, literally the first project they gave me was to build a new home office because we were moving their headquarters from Rochester, New York to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, to be on the Sara Lee campus. So I was responsible for building the building in addition to the products that were going through the product line.
Okay.
That's the main difference. And most of the time, facilities engineering in the manufacturing and operations world is different from industrial engineering and don't often report to the same boss, or at least not direct. But this was important for me and for the company because, as I said, my first job was to build the headquarters, but also the long-term strategy was to move more production offshore. Now, if you look back at what I was describing my earlier career at this point, I had not really moved production offshore. They had been tasked with it at BTK, but the logic didn't support, the analysis didn't support the timing being right or the location being right. So we never actually did it. But when we got to Champion, we were moving to Mexico, which was now roughly 15 years further advanced in steel development, working with American company development, all those kinds of things. We felt like the base was there. So we moved from about 96% production in company-owned facilities domestically. Within 4 years, we were at 50-50.
Oh, wow.
We built factories, multiple factories, and implemented very efficient production systems. And this is where we really got into the production system that I believe is the way more fashion garments should be made today. They're not, but they should be. And that's the single piece flow, lean manufacturing. Conventional sewing was and still is in more factories than it should be. It's about large volume cuttings, large volume sewing production going through at a time. And so you'll have a bundle, which is a standard unit of work. It could be 30 pieces. It could be 72 pieces. You'll have a bundle of parts of the same part, and you'll have another bundle of another part, and you'll be piecing the pieces together. So you'll sew 30 at a time of one operation, or 36 or 72 or whatever. When you finish that, you'll push it on and you'll bring in another bundle and you'll do the same thing over and over again. Single piece flow or lean manufacturing, you can cut the whole order. You only put in one piece at a time of everything. And if there are defined seven operations on a garment, you only have seven operators. And there are only seven garments in the line, or five garments, five operators in the line. And at the end of the day, you may not produce as much work out of those same five operators. I can actually show you that you would produce the same volume, the same amount of work, but it might not be the same number of finished garments, but you would have fewer garments in process. You would have garments cut and sewn and shipped the same day. And so all of our new factories that we built in Champion were all in single piece flow. So much more efficient, better operations. Now, the problem with single piece flow is it requires more machinery, because you might 20 machines in the line, and one operator actually moves from machine to machine to do her job, his or her job. That's what makes it unique. That's how you have fewer operators in place, because they do multiple operations simultaneously, or not simultaneously, but sequentially. And then they hand it off to another operator who does more pieces, more work on those same pieces. If you haven't seen it's interesting to see, but it doesn't look like conventional sewing at all. It's stand up. It's not sit down. It's moving, not staying in place. It's one piece at a time, not 35 or 40 pieces at a time.
Yeah. It would be interesting to have a discussion specifically on the difference of what would be the comparison to single piece flow. Are there just a couple of options, or everybody does it kind of differently?
It's an interesting question. At one point in my career, I had an opportunity to do some ad hoc consulting for a mid-sized regional consulting firm in the Carolinas, Georgia, and Maryland, Virginia area. And in that role, I was able to go into a machine shop that built vending machines. And what impressed me was the way that machine shops are built, and that is that they build a limited number of parts at a time, and then a different limited number of parts at a time, then a different limited number of parts at a time, and then they bring them together for final assembly. That was different from what I was used to, where the entire machine would have been gone through and built multiple parts. It was building sub-assemblies and parts and then bringing them together. If there was a comparison to make, it would be that single piece flow is more like that system, which is called job shop, as opposed to conventional bundle sewing. It's not exactly like it, but it's closer to that than it is to progressive bundles. For any of your listeners who have seen job shop, they would probably understand what I'm talking about. You can pick up the part that you need when you need it. That's really what it's based to, because you don't build an inventory. You build an inventory of availabilities, but you only bring the part together when you need it.
Yeah, I mean,
this is somewhat like just-in-time manufacturing, but it's just-in-time manufacturing right. with the entire piece going.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's surfacing into my brain is sitting with the CFO and projecting, okay, what's the return on investment 1 year, 3 year, 5 year? And I assume the conversations around cost reduction around quality. I mean, a little bit of the conundrum I suspect is, okay, you need more machines, but you have fewer operators. I'm sure the cost benefit analysis in 1 year's time isn't there. But if you care about those different things around quality versus hitting numbers in a specific time period, I suspect the decisions can change, and then the benefit certainly in the longer term outweighs the shorter term cost savings. Is that off base?
You are partly on target. But one of the things that we haven't talked about, at least not in depth, sort of touch on when I was talking about the difference between the apparel industry and the fashion industry, is that if we looked at a timeline, if we overlaid a timeline of changes in fashion retailing with my career, what you'd see is that about this point in my career, we were also at the point where companies, both wholesalers and retail companies, were saying that we're turning product faster. We need to get it faster. We need systems and source supply chains that get it to us faster. And the problem with the progressive bundle system ultimately is speed. Because the labor content is the same. 1 minute of labor to sew a seam on a garment in a progressive bundle system is the same as 1 minute of labor to sew it on in a single piece flow system. The labor content is not any different. What's different is that the output speed is much more fast, much more rapid. Done. And so I can wait to cut until I actually need the product. So now I have not created, I'm not tied up working capital in unfinished product. I have working capital in raw materials, which represents a lower cost basis. As I cut it in a progressive bundle system, now I move working capital into a different stage with much higher value now being added to it, but unavailable to me to recoup because it's sitting in WIP, it's sitting in work in process. The single piece flow, it moves right from raw materials to finished goods same day. Now, that's what I sell to the CFO. I sell to the CFO, you're not going to tie your money up sooner, tie it up later, and you're not going to wait longer to get your money back. You're going to get it back sooner. At that point, the CFO's eyes light up big time, huge. Because even though the equipment represents an investment in capital, you write it off on a slower pace because you're depreciating. It doesn't hit you as badly. It does use up the capital that you have, but you get a higher ROI on that you're producing them.
Got it. Yeah, thanks for diving into that. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's interesting, depending on the folks that we speak with, right? The conversations with the CFO are very different than the conversations we would have with the business owner, or if the strategy is defined and then they know that they want to implement functionality. This conversation around business value and the objective, to our point about translation steps, some of that gets lost along the way. And so by the time we're talking about feature functionality, it's impact to the user, and somewhere along the line, the objective and the value isn't gone. You rarely go back to it if it's not clearly defined from the organization. So, you really got to have your act together to say, hey, this is the vision. This is the strategy thereafter. Here's how we're going to measure it. And, there's lots of different ways. So evaluate it based on these things that we're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
So now, I appreciate you sharing that.
It's interesting what you said about the reaction from a CFO versus, say, the head of production or the supply chain. I'll come to that in a later in my career where it became extremely divergent. The acceptance of a strategy between those two parties was just on opposite ends of the spectrum. But I'll come to that in just a minute.
Okay.
So, from Champion, I was actually recruited away to Target. And there was a reason for that. You know, there's a lot of consolidation going on the manufacturing side of the business. Production moving offshore. I wasn't sure that I wanted to move offshore myself and lead manufacturing efforts. Whereas when Champion came calling, it was an opportunity to work on the other side and take what they wanted, what they needed was somebody that, with my type of background, because just prior to them coming to me, they had made a strategic change in their merchandising strategy, where like many retailers of that time, this was in the mid-90s, where they would go to markets, they would LA market, New York market, and they would shop different vendors' assortments. Vendors would put together these assortments. The vendors would do the design, and the buyer would go in the room, I want that, I want that, I want that. Can you make this change to that? Yes, we can do that. Can you do this in four colors? Yes, we can do that. So basically there was no brand consistency. There was no thought of brand. And this is where I learned from this. I learned the difference between a brand and a label. Because in those days, the merchandisers would relabel product, what we call today white label, private label, what back then. But Target said, look, we want it to be a brand. We actually want people to feel a branded experience, to expect consistency, to get consistency. And so they came, they recruited me. First time they called me, they said, well, you're going to work for Target. I said, holy cow. You want me to move where? To Minnesota? I'm a Southern boy.
That's
a little there for me. So they called back a few months later and said, look, we really, really just come up here. Please come up here and talk to us. It was a great, great meeting. And so I took the role. And so my job was to establish standards and methods and procedures to assure a quality branded experience. And that, by that, I mean, I didn't define the brand characteristics as far as she's a 35-year-old female with two kids. I didn't do that, but I said, okay, if she's a 35-year-old female with two kids, and this is what the brand is supposed to be, it's supposed to fill this part of her lifestyle, then these are the standards we need to put in place. This is the construction. These are the fabric types. These are the tests that we need to perform. This is the fit we need to get. And so the great thing about that for me personally, is that I literally walked in essentially carte blanche to do things the right way and not worry about preconceived notions because they had never done it before. And so I was able to do things that I was able to take advantage of all the things I learned on the other side, on the manufacturing side, to see what worked, what didn't work, and to build a system or a methodology and a process, set of processes that were unique to Target and were very successful. So for example, we were the first in the industry to do digital color evaluation. We basically said, we acknowledge the fact, most people don't understand this, but the least reliable instrument to evaluate color is the human eye. No two people see color the same way. And the same person doesn't see color the same way during the course of the day. As their eyes get tired, they see color different. So we were able to digitize that. When I say we digitized it, what I mean was we created digital color standards. We didn't tell the vendor what color to make, sending him a swatch. We sent him a digital file and said, this is the color curve you need to match. We were an initial sponsor of Size USA.
Just real quick on the standards of color, because I'm interested in that one, because I've seen inconsistencies depending on which supplier is providing that. How much variation, and I don't know if you measure it by percentage, if you give them the standards, like for instance, everybody assumes black is black, right? But there's shades of black.
Sure. And black more and white than, are the two hardest more, colors to make, by the way.
Well, maybe I should pick an easier one.
No, go with black by all means.
So if you choose that standard, how much variation do you get if you have, let's say, four or five suppliers? How close are those five swatches?
So to clarify, Target, my team did not develop the science behind digital color evaluation. That was already being done by various organizations. And so there's something called the scientific name for it, or the literal name for it, is CMC Delta E, which basically is an organization that quantified a difference, an acceptable difference through multiple years of testing and analysis between one color and another color that would be acceptable. Okay. All we did was take that CMC Delta E and begin to use it whenever color came in for approval. Now,
got it.
I can't tell you on a percentage basis. A lot of people try, but I can't tell you that it's 10% different or 5% difference. What I can tell you is within a delta of 1.0, which can be measured on an instrument, on a computer, the differences that you see are not, that you are not likely to see differences. You're not likely to. It'll look like, we used to have an expression, went hand in hand with this. We would say to the designers, first of all, don't pick two blacks, pick one black. Or if you're going to have two blacks, make sure they're far enough apart that it will look like two different blacks. Because we don't want one black that goes out there and looks like it's three different colors. We want them to be separated. That's the whole point. So we actually created an internal color space around each color in the color wheel. We just said, if you're picking a color in here, this is the color. You can't pick anything else around here because you do, you're confused the guest. Go to this different sphere and pick this blue. This sphere, pick that blue. So,
okay. Interesting.
It was a multi-year project, and we were able to upgrade keep in mind that you sort of touched on this. At Target, the volumes were so large that you had a brand and you had, let's say, a Navy. You would have multiple products in the assortment of that brand that would be that Navy. They were not made in the same textile mill. They were not dyed at the same time. They were not dyed in the same place. They were not cut and sewn in the same location, but they had to come together, and to the guest, it shouldn't matter to them. So we had to have a process that made sure that the color from mill X in China and the mill Y in Pakistan or the mill Z in North Carolina, that they all matched, that we would have to, those submittals, when they came in, we went from a 35% first time evaluation approval, 85%.
Oh.
Nobody in the industry was touching that.
Yeah.
And that's an underlying current of what I was trying to accomplish at Target. When I say I started with a clean slate, a carte blanche, if you will, to do the right thing, is I was trying to get people to understand that we want a methodology, everything that we do, that gives us an approval the first time we look at it. The first time we see something that comes from outside, we expect it to be right. And what do we have to do to make that happen? So we started with color. The next thing we moved to was fit. When you have 100 different vendors with 100 different pattern makers making garments to fit on one human body, a female, a 35-year-old female, the odds of getting them all to fit the same were pretty slim. Because we only use measurements. We tell them it needs to be this much chest or this much waist or this much hip. But we don't tell them the three-dimensional architecture of that body. I use this example. Take your finger and make a circle. Put a pencil in it. The pencil is your spine. The circle represents your hip. You can move, and your hip and your waist. You can move that thing all the way around, and you have the same measurement, but it's different architecture. And this is the human body. So we converted from, as much as we converted from providing fit guidelines in flat measurements to fit guidelines in 3D architecture. We were the first one to require our vendors to have standard mannequins to actually fit product on. And those mannequins were produced by Alvedon. We were an initial supporter of Alvedon. And Alvedon wanted to sell one mannequin. I said, no, I want 100 of them. Put them out in every vendor's location. And when we developed those mannequins, as I said, we were an initial sponsor of Size USA. So we got the data and began to analyze it first or early on. And so we developed these 3D models because Size USA was based on body scans, not flat measurements. So we were able to create the architecture of the 35-year-old female, of the 21-year-old male. So we were able to do all these different things, and we had unique bodies for each of our brands. And so when we went to that model, all of a sudden our fit approval rate, our sampling procedure went from an average of 2.5 to 3.5 samples per approval. We went to less than two. We were at over 50% of our first samples coming in were approved for fit right out of the gate.
Well, first of all, you know, it's really interesting for me to think about. So I grew up in a small town, and so in the 80s, I had a certain impression of Target. And it's interesting to talk about the standards and the brand consistency that you're talking about in the mid 90s and beyond, because my perception of the brand began to change probably in the early 2000s to, you know, consistent to, I would say, what it is today. That's one that's just kind of going off in my head. So this is really interesting to talk about, you know, the preparation and the work that was going in years in advance, right? Mm-hmm. And then two, because I think everybody could probably relate to, one, you have a vision and strategy, and what does it take to actually implement it? Like the details that proliferate over time. And then you just mentioned 3D. I'm curious, if you're doing that back then, and you have those improvements, I mean, 3D in this world and conversation on digital transformation, digital thread, and 3D in the fashion world and flow and fit and all of that. How do you view 3D today back then?
In 1999, I went to the Bobbin Show, which no longer exists. But back then, it was the industry's biggest trade event, biggest convention event, where everybody was showing off the latest, greatest widgets and everything else. I went specifically, I didn't need to go anymore in my role at Target, but I went anyway for one purpose and one purpose only. And that was to find somebody that had 3D modeling, that had digital modeling capabilities for fit evaluation. And nobody had it at the show. Went back the next year, there were like three or four vendors who are now starting to provide it. I have been an advocate of 3D modeling from that time on. I tried multiple times at Target to get a trial run. The problem at Target at that time, now Target today is using some 3D model. When I retired and they divided my job into three components, the person who took over this part of the job was able to get some 3D modeling put into effect, and it's now become a standard part of their procedures. But at that time, we had a chicken and egg scenario, because in order to do 3D modeling, you needed, because we didn't do patterns, and 3D modeling was based on patterning. You had to do the pattern first to then assemble it in three-dimensional space. We needed the vendors' pattern departments or product development departments to invest in the software. And then we needed to invest in the software to be able to evaluate it and then make modifications. And it was a chicken and egg. And so literally this went on for years. We won't do it unless you do it. We won't do it unless you do it. And so it never happened. But 3D modeling has to happen today. And our industry, the fashion industry, lags industry in general by decades in this regard. We're the last to embrace it. And there's a reason there's another reason for that. And there is that a lot of the designers, if you still think of our fashion industry as in its entirety, for every target out there, there are 500 individual designers who work on their own little niche brands or who work for smaller companies. They're very tactile. They still want to see the real product. They're very reluctant to give up that aspect of their role. And so I think that's been one of the drivers of it. There are many, many suppliers out there today who have 3D capabilities. There are more of the brands are starting with 3D.
What's your opinion in terms of that change? Is it more of organizations deciding that that's the way it's going to be? Or do you feel like it's generational in terms of if you get it into the educational programs early, especially with the younger generation can do many things on their phones still that I cannot do, but they're very familiar with it. They're comfortable with it, user friendly. And I'm sure being some of them could do designs on their phone versus, you know, needing a computer. Do you think it'll take a generation of training before 3D really takes hold? And it's this top in industry kind of treating it as R&D until it becomes a standard thing. When do you think that tipping point will happen?
I think what you're describing has already happened, is already happening. I think part of the reason that Target was able to do it in the last 10 years versus the 10 years before that is because at Target scale, the buyers who make the final approvals, the designers, the older ones are aging out and the newer ones are coming in, and the newer ones going in are getting exposed in their design schools to 3D modeling. And so there is that aging out and replacement with the newer, younger, well, differently trained people is happening. And I think that's a huge component of it. I do think that the larger the organization, the more you have the inertia of change, of having to fight the inertia of stasis. You know, this is the way we're doing it. You have to fight that more. Smaller organizations are much more rapidly adapting to it. But I do think, I'm pretty sure, I know it's being taught in the schools. The problem is we experienced this when I was still, before I retired, we would get a designer who would say, you know what, I designed in 3D when I was in school, but the buyers don't want to see it that way. That was the inertia they had to come. It wasn't that they couldn't do it, but they couldn't sell the output to the person who had to make the buy decision. Those are the people that had to age out too. And that's happened.
That's interesting. Well, just real quick, because I want to be respectful of your time. I have a little bit more time.
I do.
Okay. So I'd like to propose this because, I mean, I think we've got a lot of fascinating things throughout your career. And so maybe we put this into two sessions, if you're willing to do it. So this first session would be kind of the arc of the career, right? And we've got tangible lessons learned. And if you're up for a part two, we dive into some of these ROI things and talk about this digital transformation topic and really how to dig down and uncover it.
Okay. I'm fine with that. Let me give you one more, theoretically it's the final, but let me give you one more key takeaway from the time at Target that will lead into that next part. And that is that Target, the idea of the fashion driving sales, along with all these other quality changes that we put in, better fit, better color, better materials, et cetera, began to take hold. And we began to realize that a competitive advantage for us would be in bringing things to market faster. And so I became one of four members of what essentially was a permanent or a standing committee. We work on product development calendarization, and ancillary and associated process changes to make it real. And so for about the last 8 years I was at Target, we worked on these things. We met continuously. And one of the things that the first iteration that we rolled out after a few years of work was to take 13 weeks out of our calendar from first meeting until the product was in store. And we continue to take that down, and we learned a lot. And you know, when we talk about where we need to go as an industry or what still has yet to happen, that's going to inform a lot of the things that I would want to talk about. So I want you to be aware of that.
Yeah. I mean, taking 13 weeks, that's a full quarter.
Exactly. You
know, plus. Yeah. And I don't want to rush the career conversation, because there's plenty of fascinating things that I think are pieces of the puzzle that, you know, are worth diving into.
Oh yeah. There's more that I did. You know, we can talk about that when we come to the second phase. If I have to go back, I can go back.
Okay. So your life at Target, you talked about brand consistency, and they brought you on board for standardization and methodology. First was color. Second was fit. Were those the two main?
No. We took on fabric next. So anything that would have been considered in other industries would have been considered R&D. So fabric materials, et cetera. That also fell under my bailiwick. And the problem with fabric, remember, we were moving away. You can't move I believe when I started, we were about $5 or $6 billion in apparel sales at Target. Now, my first role at Target wasn't just Target. It was Marshall Fields. It was Dayton's. It was Hudson's. It was Mervyn's. We had close to 1,000 stores, but they weren't all Target stores at the end. And I had teams in Minneapolis. I had a team in Chicago. I ended up with teams in 7 or 8 foreign countries because of other things that we did. We began to move technical design overseas. I mean, a lot of other things that we did. But when we moved to fabric, one of the things we had to recognize that it was a slow transition to move away from the vendor developed model to the internally designed model. When we got to the internal vendor design model, vendors were picking the fabrics for us. We didn't have much choice in the fabric. As we moved to an internal design, we could pick the fabric, but we still let the vendor choose the mill. And so one of the things we had to end up doing in this transition, in this line calendarization process, is we had to bring fabric sourcing in-house, which was unusual for a retailer. So unusual for a brand, but for a retailer where we would designate, these are the mills that you have to get this fabric from. We standardized the fabric across the mill. So that was another phase of things that we did. Anything to do with R&D, we tried to standardize it to the point that that we could expect first prototype that we saw would be correct. That was the whole strategic objective. First time approval was the mantra.
And so what other components went into that? So we've got color, fit, fabric.
Trims, you know, buttons, elastics, those kinds of things all fill in. I think if there's anything else, those are probably the big ones.
Okay. I mean, all of this it's really fascinating to me.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, here's another way to also imagine the scale and why it took so long to make this transition. We had thousands of suppliers. And when I use the term supplier in this case, I really mean a vendor. I don't mean factories. We had thousands of suppliers who themselves had tens and twenties and thirties of factories. So we had thousands of factories to work with. We had hundreds of mills that we were working with. We had at sales level, we would develop from scratch. We would develop over 5,000 new specs per year that had to go through some sort of process. We had to make all those work like clockwork. And so that's one of the reasons why it took so long to make it happen, was getting all those players to understand, as I explained, when we were doing color, the changes to the color process, we were frustrated because the mills weren't playing nice with us. And as I explained to my partner in this, my color manager, I said, we understand that the industry, whether it's color in that case or fit or fabric, the industry is like a school of fish. There's hundreds of them all doing the same thing because everybody's expecting them to do it the same way. We just turn one of those fish around and we're saying, no, don't do it that way. Do it this way, because we're starting from a clean slate. We're having to try to get them all to turn around while everybody else is saying, no, we're doing it the right way. You're doing it the wrong way. And so that's the problem, is when you've got that kind of scale, but at the same time, we were able to drive sales from $5 billion in apparel per year to almost $14 billion in time frame. It was a huge change.
Yeah, that analogy is really good. And by the way, it's interesting for you to say it took a long time, but how long were you at Target?
15 years.
15 years. And so going from $5 billion to $14 billion, how long did that take?
15 years.
Okay. All right. Well, no wonder you say it took a long time, but you know, at the scale that you're talking about, it's not like you're controlling it in-house, right? You've got all of these relationships, contracts that you have to, you know, work with and get that consistency, and then see the product reviews and make sure that they're happening in a predictable manner. Yeah. And, you know, I commend you on having the patience and diligence of being able to persevere, because that's it's a fun issue to, you know, kind of encounter, and then to have a team of folks that you can collaborate with that yeah. ultimately start believing in it and saying, hey, there's something to this. I mean, it's a tremendous accomplishment.
Well, believe it or not, that's another layer to the onion. When I first took the position, I had 9 people. When I retired, I had over 200. I had to build that team. I had to put that team in place. And just like in the procedural changes with the textile mill, for example, I had to, in many cases, we were hiring people who had excellent competencies, excellent work histories, but I had to unteach them the methods that they had used before and get them to adapt what we wanted them to do. And then, of course, at some point, the light bulb went off. And then eventually, whenever we hire a new person, the first thing that the old timers would say is, don't fight it, do what they tell you, it works. It's that old thing. You have to overcome a certain amount of inertia before it begins to take hold and then grow organically. That was a lot right. of what we had to deal with.
Was there Target branded Kool-Aid that you gave the new hires?
There were more than one Target branded Kool-Aid. You want to make sure it was fried.
It was a consistent color, though, for sure.
Yes, it was. It was Target red.
Well, listen, Anton, I've got 5 pages of notes here, and I don't think we've even finished your career. We're in the middle of the Target experience, which there's a lot to dive into, but let's just take a couple minutes and just wrap this up. Let's call this one episode 1, and then let's plant the seed for what you'd like to prioritize for episode 2. I've got a number of asterisks, some things that I'd like to dive into in terms of, you know, business value. And again, tying it back to digital transformation, digital thread. But I think this is a great anchor from which to start diving into those.
Okay.
And I think people are going to get a lot of value out of this episode as well. Do you have additional thoughts of things that you'd like to prioritize?
Well, strangely enough, you know, you started out recollecting the initial conversation we had, where I was talking about getting into the, going back into the factories in my role at Target or through my team at Target and discovering the inefficiencies that were built into the cost structure. We haven't even gotten to that yet. So I think we definitely want to do that. We haven't talked about something that we had yet to talk in general, which is that another one of my functional roles at Target was to be a core member of the team that was developing the specification system, which ultimately became PLM, or became for us PLM, and other aspects of digitalization of the process. We, yes, talk about that. We have yet to talk about, I do want to come back and talk about this lean manufacturing and single piece flow and how it is and should be a basis for bringing manufacturing back to domestic facilities, and how brands and retailers can and should utilize domestic sourcing profitably, how not to view it, and how to view it, and how to use it. Those are things I do want to talk about, because I think it sort of goes to your ultimate objective, which is to talk about what needs to happen now. How can it happen? What can we do to help it along?
I think those are excellent topics, and it'll be interesting to see what feedback we get from the listeners, especially those in the RFA industry, because I know that you've been in, participated in panels in the past, and I'm envisioning some panels with some clients at upcoming conferences where these topics about domestic manufacturing and domestic sourcing and the profitability associated to those things is a very relevant topic. It's, you know, one, the sourcing issues of today with the supply chain, and then two, the global economy of, you know, there's always, you know, cheaper labor, but is that really the best balance, and what does that mix look like? So I know you've got some great insight and appreciation for it. So Anton, do you have any other words of wisdom in closing that you want to pass on at the moment?
The only word of wisdom I would pass on, based on what we've discussed to this point, is that I remember very clearly an article that was in the Wall Street Journal about 10 or so years ago. Well, must be more than 10, maybe 12 years ago, about Toyota. And it was the wisdom of Toyota that said, we will move production around the world to take advantage of markets, both labor and sales. But we will always, always, always have a factory in Japan, because we need our leaders to understand how products are made. They need to have real world hands-on experience with production. That is a missing component of what I would call training and development and career pathing opportunities in our industry today, at least in the US. We don't have, you know, what made it possible for me to be successful, maybe not the only reason, but certainly a major contributor, was having hands-on experience. It was actually working with machines, working with production workers, helping analyze fault reasons and fix them, and an understanding sequential necessities of raw materials coming in, finished products going out, et cetera, et cetera. Those things would benefit our industry a lot if we would do more of that. And I think that's a missing component. And that's the part of my career that I wish I could pass on to other people. You know, that type of knowledge, I won't call it wisdom, but that type of knowledge is something that I think would help a lot if we had more of that in abundance. And unfortunately, because of the way we've transitioned the industry, whether it's through, you know, NAFTA, which everybody wants to blame, it was happening before NAFTA, let's be honest about it, that all of it was open the spigot a little bit bigger. But, you know, we've abandoned it, recognizing the good that we've lost. And that, I think that I wish more people would have the opportunity to do that. And the desire. It's so impactful, so helpful.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And I think, especially coming out of the pandemic, I feel that people have a bigger appreciation, at least for the moment, of that personal connection. Yeah. And you know, I was just on a virtual call yesterday and everybody was on camera and somebody was in the office, like corporate office, and everybody was kind of shocked because
what are you doing?
We just did a year program and everybody was virtual, you know, and coming out and then they're back in the office. But it enhances the relationship, it enhances the understanding, it expedites alignment, and ultimately, to your point, those tangible experiences that help you make better decisions. And I think that's great insight. And that article and the philosophy of Toyota in Japan, I think it's very relevant. So thanks for sharing that. Yeah.
All right. Well, Anton, I've taken up a lot of your time today, but
it's been great.
Thank you. I feel the same way, and I'm really inspired, and I'm really excited to share all this information with the audience, and very interested to hear everybody's feedback. And so if you thought this was great, I know that the next episode is going to be great. So everybody, thank you so much for joining. Anton, I appreciate everything that you shared today and the collaborative conversation. It's been really fun for me.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. It's been great. Thank you.
Great. All right, everybody. So look out for episode 2 and we'll continue to have further discussion. If you want to reach out to me or anybody at Archer Gray, feel free. You can go at info@archergray.com, and that's G-R-E-Y, since we're talking about colors. Let's get specific. So thank you again for listening, and we will look forward to connecting with you guys soon. Take care.